thought we would continue on with our talk on the Noble Eightfold Path, the fourth factor of the Four Noble Truths. Last time we talked about right understanding and right thoughts and what we mean by the word right. And there's a way we should all, there's a way in which we can think of the word right as in dualistic terms, right as in the opposite of wrong, as in the right and true way. And that's a little bit dangerous, kind of in terms of Zen practice. We should all at least consider the consider what it means to practice correctly, and to consider what it means to practice what the Buddha actually taught rather than what we think it was. That makes sense? And in that sense, we're constantly aiming our aspiration a little higher than we might think. Or Master G used to like to say, it's really important not to bring the teaching down to our level. I think I've said a number of times, we start off on the road of practice because we believe that there's some understanding that we don't have, that there's something that we want to learn, that there's something we want to awaken to. And that implies that we're going into some area that we don't know. We're going into the unknown. A lot of people, however, when they go into that unknown and they get and they say, oh, the Buddha was enlightened, he was great, I've read his teaching, that looks very interesting, I want to find out about that. And then when they head off down the road of practicing the Buddha Dharma, they might encounter something which they think is wrong about the Buddha Dharma, or that the Buddha Dharma is pointing at. And it's possible that what they're encountering is wrong, but it also is possible that it's pointing toward the very thing which obscures them from awakening to what they wish to awaken to. In other words, I might think to myself, the law of karma is too hard. The world doesn't really work like that, that the law of karma isn't really true. And so I don't really believe that it's true when I'm confronted with it. And then therefore fall away from practice. Instead of saying, oh, this is interesting. Why am I reacting so much to this? Why am I having such a strong reaction to the idea of the law of karma? Why does it seem to me to be too hard? What is really going on there in terms of my own self? What is really going on there in terms of my own understanding? So, and further exploration might indicate that we had misinterpreted what was talked about in terms of the law of karma, for instance. We might have a misunderstanding about what that really means. And that misunderstanding is, again, what we're talking about bringing the teaching down to our level. Instead of bringing ourselves up to the level of the Dharma, what was the Buddha talking about? The Buddha's intention was to help us to find that which doesn't suffer, or find out how to suffer less. So if I find myself suffering a lot because of my practice, what's really going on there? What's really happening there? So, right, in one sense, the word right means what actually works. What actually works to help facilitate our walking the path of the truth, or walking a spiritual path. What actually helps us to go forward in our practice. Okay. It doesn't mean the only way that a being can find salvation. It just means what actually works. Tonight, I thought we would talk about the three factors on the Eightfold Path: right speech, right action, and right livelihood. These these are sometimes grouped together as the moral aspect of practice, or the precept-related aspect of practice of the Eightfold Path. And in a sense, as we study them and understand them, they reveal the kind of formal external qualities of practice, what we're doing with our physical body and mind and mouth, what we're actually doing in practice. Although, so so they have this formal quality to them, but there's also a deeper aspect of these which pertain to meditation. Let me just go through the classic understanding of these three, and then we can talk about this other aspect of it. Right speech, of course, has to do with telling the truth, not lying, not slandering. Speech which encourages practice, which encourages beings. Speech which is kind, which is not. Often right speech is talked about not being frivolous speech, and not being speech which distract us or other beings from the kind of purpose of our presence here, whatever that present purpose means. That could be distracting your coworkers at work, for instance, something like that, with gossip. Right speech, like all three of these things that we are talking about tonight, has also the quality of speech which is true, which is not only factually true, but speech which is true in the sense that it is reflective of our relationship with the deepest truth, okay, which is in harmony with the deepest truth. Right action refers to action, kind of perceptual action, action refraining from killing, stealing, immoral sexuality. But it also has to do with helping beings, protecting beings, making offerings to beings, making offerings to the world. Okay, so it's action from the mind of benevolence, action from the mind of charity and kindness. And again, it's also action that is in harmony with what is true, with what is kind of actually true, kind of factually true, the two different levels of truth, but also the deepest truth in terms of Buddha nature. And right livelihood is a kind of subset of right action, in a sense. It is, how we go about earning a living, basically, as it implies. But it's also how we sort of tend to our own needs and care in the world. Okay, it's not just the job that we do, but how we sort of tend to our life, how we tend to kind of supporting our existence. And in also in that respect, it has to do with what is true, being in harmony with what is true. The right part of it means a livelihood that is in harmony with what is true. Dogen says in the Shishogi that it is an act of charity to build ferry or bridge, and all forms of industry are charity if they benefit others. In the sense that right livelihood is in harmony with truth has more to do with whether or not it benefits beings than any kind of ideal. I was talking to a fellow who was a really amazing carpenter. He had this amazing gift with fine woodworking and making furniture. And he was also had an alcoholism problem, and was doing his best to practice. And so he was doing kind of this fine woodworking, and it ended up working for really wealthy people, doing things like making pool tables for them, or just kind of furniture for their houses. And at one point when I talked to him, he had, I knew him over a number of years, and didn't see him very often, just would see him when he would come from retreats at Shasta. And we worked together on some projects, doing some woodworking projects for the Abbey. And at one point, he told me that he had really worked hard on his alcoholism problem, was into some kind of rehabilitation program, and was considering becoming a therapist of some kind, a social worker or a psychologist or something like that, setting aside his carpentry work because he, as he said, he didn't really feel like it was kind of right livelihood to work for rich people. To make these nice things for rich people. And while I didn't say anything to him at this point, this is something that I've encountered quite a bit, that people, when they come in contact with practice, they start to practice, they think they ought to be doing some kind of helping profession. And that is really what is like right livelihood. And it made me a little bit sad that he, this really gifted woodworker, was unable to find a way to integrate that into his practice, and needed to sort of look outside of himself for this externally, socially accepted way of helping people. All forms of industry or charity if they benefit beings. And that means, like, I remember going to some, I remember as a young man visiting a house that, of some wealthy people, and I didn't spend a lot of time. You probably can imagine I didn't spend a lot of time kind of thinking, oh, I really want to be rich and have nice things. But I did really appreciate nice things, and I was kind of cheering to be able to go to visit this house and see the nice things that these people have. You know, sort of like going to a museum in a way, I guess. That there is an offering that we make when we do a thing well, whatever that thing is, whether we think that it is, whether it's kind of socially accepted as the right thing to do, as a good thing to do, as a socially beneficial thing to do, or not. I had another person that I met when I was a young man who was... it's beginning his career as an investment banker on Wall Street. And I was doing Zen practice and thinking about becoming a monk at the time and all this stuff. And when I would talk to him, there was this kind of thing, you're doing the good thing and I'm not doing the good thing. But the thing about it was, he just really loved being a banker. It was just something that he was really good at, and he loved doing that thing. And from my point of view, I was kind of glad that That was what he was, how he was pursuing his life. Even though from the kind of social background that we both kind of came from, being an investment banker was kind of looked down at, down on at the time. You know? There is nothing in Buddhism, the nice thing about Buddhism, there is no kind of formal requirement to do one thing or another. It has more to do with being in harmony with what is true within yourself and the conditions that you find yourself in. What is appropriate for you? So for me, what was appropriate for me to do when I was in the world was being a baker. And I was being a baker for rich people. One of the people that I worked with, who was in a kind of emotion, she was actually pregnant and was having all kinds of hormonal kind of issues, but one day she just really kind of let loose and said, "I can't stand working for rich people." Just again, this kind of idea, like being of service to people who don't really need your service. There's something to be looked down upon there. But to me, you know, I was just thinking, well, these rich people suffer too, so I'm going to kind of, and I need to do my job, so I'm going to just do my job. And I'm going to do it as well as I can. I'm going to give my love, my heart, in a way, to the work that I'm doing. We think also in terms of work and livelihood and action that we should find something that we love to do and do that thing, and then we'll be happy or fulfilled. And to a certain extent, that is true. There is a truth in that. But it's also equally true that we can do whatever it is that we're doing, whether it's cleaning toilets or serving people as a doctor or a priest or a social worker or whatever it is. We can turn around and do that thing as an offering of love, as an offering of charity, as an offering of benevolence. There's a great story which I've told in Aoyama Roshi's book,
Zen Seeds,
thank you, about a factory, a corporate worker who reported the story of their bathroom, I think it was the men's bathroom in their corporate headquarters or whatever, where people started writing graffiti on the wall. And there was a woman who would clean that bathroom, and she left a note on the wall to the people who were writing graffiti, please do not deface my good workplace. She actually took pride in her workplace and the place that she was working, just cleaning the toilets. This is where I gain my respect. Please don't disrespect me and what I'm doing and this good workplace. And people saw that and saw the sincerity of it, and apparently the graffiti stopped. We have all manner of ideas about how we should be, what we ought to be doing, what all that kind of stuff. And part of those ideas form what we choose ultimately to do with our lives. And that's fine. That's just the normal course of events. That's just how it goes. But I think the point that I'm trying to make in these little stories is we can bring an idealism to what we do in the world, our right livelihood, our right action, gets in the way of the actual kind of thing of our life, the actual core of our life, the actual life of our life. And we can add layers to it that make us miss something, actually make us miss where we're going to find satisfaction. To shift gears a little bit, in terms of, and this all does relate to right, this kind of wider area of right action, and the truth of being in harmony with Buddha nature, being in harmony with what is true. In terms of practice, it's classically the case that in Buddhism, it is taught that we will, we have lived many lives previous to this one, and we will likely live lives future to this one. And so we are given an opportunity to kind of find our faults and correct them over time. And that, there's a lot of wisdom in that, and I don't want to completely discard that or undermine it. But there's also a way in which we can, in a way, defer our life to a point in the future where it will be better. That I think is kind of a dangerous thing to be thinking of. I remember giving a Dharma talk to some friends in Montana, and River Master Hario was there, and he pinned me down on this point. And I can't remember exactly what he said, but it was sort of like, well, what happens if there isn't another chance? You know, what about this moment right here? And I had to think about that and think, oh, that's a pretty good point. Because we're constantly bringing ourselves outside of the present moment to the future. Oh, I blew that, but the future's okay. Mm-hmm. Instead of really just sitting still with what it's like to have blown that. Maybe sitting still with what it's like to have blown that really doesn't matter. Maybe we realize, oh, that doesn't really matter. And here I am in this completely new moment where things are actually different than I thought they were. Because I was kind of caught up in this distraction about the future. So it's this idea in practice where we're constantly bringing ourselves back to the present moment, constantly just letting go of whatever is going on in our bodies and minds. The idea of meditation, constantly bringing ourselves back to the here and now and responding with the life that we have to what is here in this present moment. With the life of the precepts, with the life of meditation, and just the life of our own kind of wise discernment about what is good to do. Each one, and this is the kind of the great thing about the Dharma and why there is no prescription about what right livelihood specifically means. There's a couple of things that it says that we shouldn't do, you know, don't engage in slave trade, don't become a drug dealer, don't deal in flesh, you know, stuff like that. Those are the three main things. Obviously, you shouldn't become a thief or, you know, do things which are completely contradictory to the precepts. But it doesn't actually say what we should do. It doesn't even give us any clues about, oh, really, it's a lot better to be a carpenter than it is to be a steam fitter. Okay? Got that? No, nothing like that. There's no, nothing like that. Every kind of person can do practice and find Buddha nature in whatever life they are living. All forms of industry or charity, if they benefit others. And so what we can do in this present moment is take the industry that we've been given and make it into an offering to benefit other beings. What we can do is take this moment, whatever we're doing, and make it into an offering both to ourselves and other beings, just by being still, letting go of what's going on in our minds, and doing our best to just respond to the moment as a real person, as just a person. Again, River Master Hario had this great line. He said, if you want to become enlightened and you drop something, pick it up. Okay? It's just that response from the reality of this particular life, this particular moment. And in that sense, we're letting go of the doctrine, we're letting go of the procedures, we're letting go of whatever is going on, and just living. We do that in the context of our formal practice. You know, and particularly this is an interesting thing for a monk who's kind of deeply immersed in formality to be kind of talking about or teaching. But there's a point, well, actually, there isn't a point, it's this way right from the beginning, where you just have to let go of the form. You have to do the form, but let it go. And in being able to do the form and let it go, there's something that we find. There's something, a deeper kind of understanding that we come to. Does that make sense? Some notes for myself, which I think I can remember, but it will really be better if I have the notes. Oh, never mind. Now, to shift gears a little bit. There is, in terms of right action, there's a way in which we The thing we talk about quite a bit is the balance between will and willingness. The balance between, in a way, making something happen and just going along with the flow of things. And while these two things are not in mutual conflict, they are aspects of the same thing, it's sometimes hard to find a balance between these things. And I was reminded of an aspect of what is true that I thought might be useful to talk about tonight. We, in a way, this idea of being formal and going into formlessness that I was talking about before is how we study and come to understand the precepts better. So we read the precepts, don't kill, don't steal, don't lie. And those have a formal quality to them. We know that killing, an example of killing is taking a knife and putting it through the heart of somebody. Okay? That's kind of the grossest formal way of killing. And there are different grades of killing that go down to turning a cold shoulder to someone or not paying attention when they give expression to some mild need, something like that. We kill their Buddha nature by giving them disrespect or something like that. And so part of the truth that we're in harmony with in terms of right action is the truth of causality. Okay? And in a way, I want to kind of zoom out our view of it to go beyond to just the precepts. There is a moral quality to this, but to kind of step it back a minute into a kind of non-doctrinal place and just say the truth of causality. What really, to see clearly, what really are the lines of causality for our actions? And in that way, by looking at it in that way, then we begin to see, oh, what am I really doing in this particular moment, and how does that play out in terms of causality? There is a kind of, I was reminded of this recently, where there's a, and in terms of, there's a kind of way in which we kind of think that violence is a necessary aspect of life. And in other words, it's kind of necessary to get something done. And I want to just raise a question about whether that is really true, whether that's really in accord with causality that we want to follow. In other words, is it really worth doing violence to get something done in terms of the actual consequences of violence? The kind of violence I'm talking about, again, is not paying it, like the kind of thing where you want to get something done and you don't really pay attention to what the consequences for others will be. And how we think about how we justify violence in that way. I mean, there is this, that old saying, if you want to make an omelet, you got to break eggs. And to a certain extent, I make a lot of omelets. you know, I do cooking here, and I scramble eggs quite a bit, so I'm kind of thinking about breaking eggs a lot. And I'm not necessarily saying that that is wrong or untrue, just something to reflect on. How do we force other people to do what we want them to? How do we, in subtle and coarse ways, manipulate circumstances so they turn out how we want? There is a mudra in one of our books, which Reverend Master Jiu describes as the offering mudra, where you just sit or lie down with your hands open, you know, palm up, either in your lap or down to your side. And that offering mudra is both offering ourselves up and being willing to receive what the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas have to teach. As a sort of side note, you tend to want to not, you know, kind of be doing an offering mudra on the bus in the middle of rush hour, or, you know, at the local bar or someplace, you know, where you might be inviting something kind of coarse to influence you. In the context of our, you know, kind of private home or meditation hall or something like that, we can do this offering mudra, where we are, again, offering ourselves to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and asking for, to receive what they, how they want to influence us. And in this way, what we're kind of saying is that nice Christian idea, thy will, Lord, and not mine. Kind of saying to Buddha nature, what I would really like to do is let go of my selfishness and follow the will of Buddha nature, in a way. And this is, you know, I want to be kind of careful here. This is something that is quite personal. It is quite, in a way, private, something that we can each do and we each, in some sense, interpret. I can't say so-and-so is really doing the will of the Buddha nature, you know, of anybody, really. Even, you know, people whose training I look at with awe. It's a kind of personal and private matter. And in a sense, this idea of violence, of excess will, goes to the heart of this offering issue, this offering matter. Because that violence or excessive will is really kind of saying, no, It's my will and not Buddha nature's will. Okay. And so this is something for myself I've tried to do. I've tried to kind of lead my life in this way. Tried to say, well, what is really good for me to do in terms of following Buddha nature? What's really good? And oftentimes it just sort of is apparent that what is just needing to be done is just what needs to be done. You know, get up in the morning, go to meditation, sit, eat breakfast, do my work, get things done, do what needs to be done. That's, you know, kind of where it is. I think something, however, shifts in my mind in how I do those things, how I go about that day, when I approach it in that way, when I approach it in that sense of, well, what is really good to do? The other day, Reverend, one of the monks here had a doctor's appointment, so I offered to just drive them to the doctor. Sorry, out of the blue. And that was fine, so I did that. And it was in various ways an unsatisfactory trip, but I kept having this feeling that there was something to do. And just on the way home, we passed this person in the neighborhood who was having some car trouble. So I took the monk home and let them off and went back and helped the person with the car trouble. It was really a minor thing, quite minor. But kind of down to even how I was dressed, it was kind of like by being willing to, as I was leaving, I was having this, I often will go out in robes, and this time I had this feeling, oh, you should wear your street clothes, work clothes or whatever. And so, you know, kind of even down to that level, I was kind of trying to follow my just intuition of what needs to be done. And in the end, I was kind of glad that I wasn't wearing robes and could help this person with their car and do what needed to be done. And, you know, and it wasn't like there were any bright lights or, you know, kind of nobody stood up and clapped or did anything like that when I did this thing. She was just a minor matter. And still, there was something about it that was like, this is what needed to be done. And then not even in a cosmic way, but just this is what needed to be done. When we can kind of live on that level of just intuition of and that direct relationship with our life, then there is a kind of, as a consequence of that, a kind of satisfaction that arises, a kind of being able to live with ourself, you know, live honestly with ourself and be at peace with ourself. And somebody wise once told me, you know, if you're trying to think about what you want to do with your life, use projective hindsight. Think about what you might think of at age 70, how you might look back on your life and ask yourself what you would want to see at age 70 about your life, what decisions you would want to have made. And I found that to be kind of helpful and think to myself every now and then I'll kind of take a look back and think, okay, well, you know, like I say, nobody stood up and clapped, but I didn't do too bad so far, you know. And this then goes to the issue of right action, right speech, right livelihood, the things that we do, the consequences that we make in our life. As we're going forward, they may seem quite mundane, all foolish seem and dull, but as we're going forward and we're being careful in that way, we gradually construct a life that we look back upon and think, oh, that was okay, not too bad. So I think that's what I had to say this evening. Are there any questions or thoughts? Okay, well, thank you.